Dateline Washington, Monday, May 4th, 2009. Hello again from the nation's capital. I'm Greg Corumbus. In this edition, growing concern over Pakistan. Militant and radical forces, including the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, are within 60 miles of the Pakistani capital. Will the government survive? And how safe are the dozens of nuclear weapons? Also in this edition, remembering a conservative icon. Jack Kemp, the longtime congressman and one-time vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party, passed away of cancer over the weekend at age 73. We'll remember his legacy, particularly his economic supply-side legacy in connection with Ronald Reagan, with Frank Donatelli, chairman of GOPAC and former political director in the Reagan White House. Plus, Obama wants more business taxes. The president says he's going after tax shelters and havens of companies that don't want to pay American taxes on profits they've made overseas. We'll find out just how bad this could be for our economy when we speak with Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform. And assessing Chrysler and GM, we'll talk about both as well as President Obama calling out the creditors when we speak with Marty Padgett of thecarconnection.com. All that plus Monday's headlines are straight ahead on Dateline Washington. We begin with the trouble in Pakistan, and we begin right now. My first guest in this edition is David Gardenstein Ross, Vice President for Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies here in Washington. We want to get his thoughts as more U.S. officials say they are increasingly concerned about the advance of radical militants such as the Taliban towards the Pakistani capital of Islamabad, and they're even a little bit worried about the security of Pakistan's dozens of nuclear weapons. And David, thanks so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure.
How much more serious is this than, say, when you and I talked a few weeks ago?
Well, the situation is it's basically degenerating fairly quickly. The Taliban has been able to advance within 60 miles of the capital at one point. The Pakistani military has fought them intermittently, yet seems ultimately to want to push back from the combat to reassert the predominance of peace treaties between them and the Taliban. What this is increasingly highlighting is the inability of the Pakistani military to drive Taliban militants out of the areas that they've captured within Pakistan.
What about the fact that the Taliban doesn't seem to be honoring any of these deals? Why do they still believe that that's the way to get this done?
Well, interpreting it in the best light possible, we can go to an editorial that Hussein Haqqani, the ambassador from Pakistan to the United States, wrote in the Wall Street Journal fairly recently. And there he talks about this as a means of trying to separate tribal elements from the Taliban. His argument is that within some of these areas, there are people who aren't militants, who aren't jihadists, who want to see the implementation of Islamic law. And by allowing that to be implemented at a regional level, it can satisfy this demand and peel away this element of appeal that the Taliban has. That is, the Taliban claims to speak for Islam, and the argument that the Pakistani government makes in return via these treaties is you don't have to have the Taliban in order to have Sharia be incorporated into the regional law. Rather, you can get that through treaties with the Pakistani government. It can be done peacefully rather than through militancy. Now, I'm not saying that I support the Pakistani government's position. I'm just putting it in the light most favorable to them, and I'm outlining what they would say about their own policies.
Is this similar in some way, David, to what happened in the Anbar province and elsewhere in Iraq, where eventually the locals just got tired of the heavy-handed oversight of, at that point, Al-Qaeda in Iraq and so forth? Or is that not necessarily a great parallel?
No, it's not a great parallel. I don't see evidence of that happening in Pakistan. You don't have anything in Pakistan that's analogous to the awakening movement that you had in Iraq. In fact, one of the things that people pushed back against in Iraq was the very brutal form of Sharia law that Al-Qaeda in Iraq implemented. If you look from region to region within Iraq, areas where Al-Qaeda was able to control territory, they did things like ban cucumbers and tomatoes next to each other on a vegetable stand. They banned ICE because it didn't exist during Prophet Muhammad's time, and they were very brutal about enforcing it. The rules that they implemented would be funny if not for the fact that people died because of them. In this case, what the Pakistani government is doing is ceding to the kind of Sharia law that the Taliban elements want to implement. I don't see evidence that as a result of that there's any sort of anti-Taliban, anti-Al-Qaeda movement that's been in the formation stages.
Well, given the degeneration of events here, as you described it a little bit earlier, David, what's the best hope here for staving off this push towards Islamabad in realistic terms?
Well, people in Islamabad are definitely worried that the Taliban could advance on their city. Given that it's the capital of Pakistan and given the terrain that surrounds Islamabad, I think the Pakistani military would be able to fight off any sort of challenge that the Taliban mounted against Islamabad. The only condition under which they wouldn't be able to fight off a Taliban advance is if the army doesn't want to do so. Now, I have some colleagues who are smart people and keen observers of Pakistan who think that that may be the case, that the army still hasn't made up its mind yet. I'm not that skeptical as they are. I believe that the Pakistani army is on the side of Pakistan's government and would defend it against an attack on Islamabad. That would have tremendous international implications if Islamabad fell to the Taliban. But look, right now, this is the answer to your question, what would be the best way to stave off the Taliban advance, is fairly simple. Keep fighting the Taliban. Take the fight to them. Push them back. Don't use scorched earth tactics when you fight. Rather, fight a counterinsurgency campaign where part of what you're trying to do is to win the hearts and minds of the local population. Right now, it seems that the leadership is dithering, that sometimes they'll mobilize forces and fight the Taliban, and then the next second, they're reasserting the primacy of peace deals and trying to assert that these peace deals are still predominant. It's very difficult to do both. You have to choose whether you're going to fight them or whether you think you can negotiate your way out of this. And if you plan to negotiate your way out of it, then you need a negotiation strategy that will work.
We're talking with David Gartenstein-Ross of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. And David, you talked about the hearts and minds effort. We're also hearing, and not surprisingly, that the Taliban and these other radicals are using human shields in their fight against the Pakistani military. Ultimately, will that backfire the more people learn about that, if they learn about that? Or will people just see the fact that when the Pakistanis fire back at the militants, they're killing civilians?
If you look in Iraq, the area where Al-Qaeda in Iraq was least popular is areas that they controlled. The closer people were to AQI, the more they disliked that terrorist organization. That was a good thing for the U.S. military. And conversely, when I was in Iraq and thereafter, talking to military planners and going out on patrols, one thing that struck me is that the best PR for the United States is the American military itself. Now, that's obviously not universally the case. There have been some abuses by soldiers, but generally, when Iraqi people see the professionalism of the U.S. military and see that the U.S. military really is there to protect them, to try to make sure they get basic services and the like, it changes a lot of the it changes a lot of the things they heard about the U.S. military. A lot of them have heard very bad things, and having a U.S. soldier face to face with them and seeing that they're not there to steal things from you, they're not there to rape your women, they're not there to attack you, that's something which is effective in changing minds. Now, looping it back to Pakistan, one difference between the U.S. military and the Pakistani military is level of professionalism. When the Pakistani military has fought over the past year and a half or so, it's often employed scorched earth tactics, basically destroying everything in sight, which even though the bad guys are using human shields, the Pakistani military isn't exactly trying to avoid hitting the human shields. Rather, they do incalculable human damage to the areas where they're trying to fight the militants. So changing those strategies really would help the Pakistani military. I mean, I'd say the answer to your question is somewhere in the middle. People aren't blaming the Pakistani military entirely, but neither are they blaming Al-Qaeda and the Taliban entirely, given that neither side has completely clean hands right now.
David, in terms of what help the Pakistani government and military might want from us, is it entirely money? Is there something else we can do?
Well, there's other things that we can do. We can train them in counterinsurgency operations. We can provide them with technology to fight these kinds of operations. In the past, for example, we've provided them with a lot of F-16s. We haven't provided them with helicopters, and you need helicopter gunships in order to carry out these operations more effectively. So gearing our military assistance to the kind of military technology that you would need to fight against an insurgency, that's an important part of what we can do for them. I think that there has to be a few different levels of what we try to accomplish with Pakistan. We do need to give them monetary assistance because ultimately a poor economy, loss of hope within Pakistan is something that will help the militants. On a second level, military-to-military assistance, along with gearing our training, gearing our hardware to fighting against insurgencies. And a third thing, to the extent that it's feasible, cooperation between the U.S. military and the Pakistani military. There are some problems with this last option, because the Pakistani military has had a number of sympathizers with religious extremism who've been a part of it, which makes sharing too much information a little bit precarious. But nonetheless, to the extent that you can have military-to-military cooperation, that can also help in fighting against the insurgency that Pakistan is witnessing within its own borders.
David, a couple minutes left in our conversation here, and from what you've said so far about Islamabad and its defensibility, it sounds like the report that there may be another military takeover of the government in order to stave off this advance towards the capital may not have as many legs to it as we might suspect on the surface.
I'm very skeptical of those reports at the very outset. Now, it's not at all impossible that this would happen within Pakistan. But remember, Pakistan just emerged from about 8 years of military rule under Musharraf, and the military believes that it lost a great deal of prestige during this period. Now, part of that can be attributed to Musharraf's own incompetence. It can be attributed to the fact that he was, to put it mildly, not a solid leader of the country. Now, he executed his coup as the chief of staff for the armed forces. He was the top guy there. It wasn't the kind of mid-level coup that you have gotten, for example, in Libya many years ago. If you look at the top leadership right now, Kayani, I don't think, is going to execute a coup. That's my own take on the situation. I mean, I've read the reports, but those reports strike me as being awfully alarmist.
And so the fact that the government's probably stable, not at risk of a takeover imminently, means the nukes are probably safe, at least for now as well, correct?
Yes, at least for now. I mean, I'm worried about the nuclear weapons if there's a popular uprising, if there's an Islamist coup and the like. But if you have simply, you know, Kayani taking over to try to stabilize the country, that's not the kind of thing that makes me fear for the nuclear weapons.
David, unfortunately, we need to stop there. Thank you, sir, as always, for your time.
Pleasure.
David Gardenstein-Ross, Vice President for Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. This is Dateline Washington.